Welcome to Under Lock and Key, news and commentary about prisons from the Revolutionary Anti-Imperialist League.
This is Howard Zinn. Slavery is back. In fact, it was never abolished. In 1865, the 13th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution abolished slavery, except in prison. At the current rate of incarceration, by the year 2010, the majority of all African-American men between 18 and 40 will be in prison, the state as their captor, and their labor on the auction block.
The U.S. incarcerates a greater percentage of its population than any other country, sending more black men to prison than to college. The purpose of this program is to educate about and inspire activism against the American lockdown.
Howard Zinn was recorded for the Mumia Abu Jamal All Things Censored CD. He is exactly right. Slavery was never abolished, and it is alive and well today in American prisons. Prisoners have always done the bulk of the work of running the prisons as the wage slaves of the government. Now the corporations are getting in on the act. The Wisconsin Department of Corrections advertises prison slave labor to corporations, saying, "Can't find workers? A willing workforce awaits." The rapid expansion of prison labor is not an accident, but a plan concocted at the top of the American government. Listen to what Supreme Court Chief Justice Warren Burger had to say on the subject back in 1981. "What I propose is that as we embark on this massive prison construction program, we try a new approach, convert our warehouses into factories with fences around them. To do that, we must change our thinking and change the reactionary statutes that stand in the way. I believe the American people are ready to do that." Since 1979, with the federal creation of Prison Industry Enhancement, or PI, regulations, corporations have been allowed into the prisons to exploit prisoner slave labor. These regulations, which include paying prisoners the prevailing wage, must be met before the products of prisoners' labor can be sent across state lines. There is considerable effort underfoot to weaken these regulations, thereby making it possible for corporations to more easily exploit prisoner labor to make their products. Companies like Microsoft have used prisoners to package their products, such as Microsoft Office. Eddie Bauer makes jeans in a Tennessee prison, and Honda makes car parts in an Ohio prison. All of these companies get to credit their products as made in the USA. State-owned industries get in on the act, too. While the U.S. criticizes Chinese prison slave labor being used for export, the states of California and Oregon are in direct competition with China. The California Department of Corrections has a line of clothing designed for export to the Asian market. And the Prison Blues brand of clothes made by prisoners in Oregon boasted of projected export sales of $1.2 million in 1994. A minute ago, we stated that PI requires prisoners to be paid prevailing wages for their work. But this doesn't mean that the prisoners actually get those wages. Often, the great majority of wages are deducted for various state programs, including paying for the prison. In Washington State, 20% of wages are deducted for the cost of corrections. 10% goes towards non-interest-bearing mandatory savings, 5% for a victim's compensation fund, and then federal tax, Medicare tax, and Social Security are deducted. Prisoners could then see a real wage of $1.80 to $2.80 an hour. But it could be even less, as the law allows up to 80% of the wage to be deducted. But even in that case, 98 cents an hour is more than prisoners can earn in a non-PI work. So these jobs are in high demand. And of course, prisoners often have to support themselves while they are in prison. Toiletries must be paid for, as must medical care. While paying prevailing wages might be an inconvenience to the corporations, they make their money back in other ways. Corporations don't pay prevailing rents to the prison. In fact, often free or $1 a year, like Exmark Corporation in Washington State. And the prison provides services that the corporation would otherwise have to pay for, such as warehouse security and supervising workers. This all ends up as more exploitation of prisoners' labor and yet another government subsidy to the corporations.
American weapons of mass destruction are made in prison. The Federal Prison Industries, or Unicor, manufactures equipment and supplies for the U.S. military. Entry-level wages are 23 cents an hour. The Federal Bureau of Prisons boasts that the slave labor of prisoners has and continues to make significant contributions towards supplying the needs of the military. Unicorps' military production ranges from TOW and other missile cables, munitions components, communications equipment, bomb parts, engine overhauls, uniform sewing, and so on. 26% of federal prisoners work in Unicorps. The two notorious supermaxes of the federal system, Marion and Florence, require work in Unicorps as a condition of transfer. While most Unicorps work is military-related, all Unicorps work in these two dungeons of political repression is military-related. The prison at Lexington, Kentucky, made infamous by the video Through the Wire, typically sells $12 million in products to the military.
What happens when workers are injured on the job? When workers outside of prison are injured on the job, they are insured certain protections by law. In prison, it's another matter altogether. Nancy, a prisoner at FCI Dublin, explains what happened to her when she was injured on the job in prison.
This is Nancy again. I have one last incident that happened to me personally with our fine medical establishment. This was here in California. My job was in a furniture factory, and I was in the packing department. We would take quite large desks, like 72 inches by 36 inches, that are made out of press board, which is heavier than real board, and we'd have to lift them up, put them on pallets, box them up, ship them out, that sort of thing. I was working there, and at one point, I injured my back on the job, and since I had done it there, they sent me over to the medical just to, you know, report it, document that I had an on-the-job injury. And they examined me and said, yeah, there's not a whole lot you can do but rest, and it should take you about 8 weeks for your back to heal and be back to normal. They then proceeded to write me a one-day lay-in, which meant that I could have one day off of work, and the following day I would be right back out on the packing floor. There's a lot of women, as in anywhere, that abuse the privilege of going to medical and getting a lay-in because they don't want to work or they can't work. But in 6 years, I've only had two lay-ins, once when I sliced my finger and once when I hurt my back. And they would not extend it. They wouldn't in any way cooperate with this healing process. It was fortunate for me that my boss knew me. I'd worked for him for some time, and he knew I wasn't, you know, a malingerer. And he allowed me to do light duty. And on occasion, when there wasn't anything at all happening, he would allow me, send me back to the unit and make arrangements with the officer over there to allow me to go back. But, you know, it's difficult from our end when we're told that, okay, this is something that will take 8 weeks to heal, but no, you can't have any time off. You cannot protect yourself from this. You must go back into the exact same environment that injured you. And we have no control over ourselves. If we wake up and you're sick, and normally you'd get up and say, hey, I can't come into work. We don't have that option. There's certain days of the week when they won't even have medical here unless it's an emergency and they'll bring them in from somewhere. So you can only get sick on certain days of the week, and hopefully you don't get injured too bad, because, you know, there may be nothing you can do but work with your injuries.
Nancy was recorded by the November Coalition for a CD entitled Voices from the Drug War.
Corporate advocates and some prison officials say that prison labor is good for prisoners because it gives them experience they will need to get jobs on the outside. In one sense, Rail could agree. Like any disciplined labor system, it serves the ideological function of preparing workers for wage work in an alienating, hierarchical economy. If prisoners have not had proper education before going to jail, teaching them how to be good workers, then the prison might play that role, and they might even be better off for it when they get out than some other prisoners are. But by the same logic, slaves in the Old South who learned how to grow cotton might have made better sharecroppers than those who did not. Either way, first they were slaves, then they were sharecroppers. Rail's criticism is of the system. If the system wanted people to get good jobs, they never would have made them penniless criminals in the first place. Furthermore, prison slave labor is not training for jobs on the outside. Many of the jobs done by prisoners are done only in two places, prison and third world sweatshops. From reviewing the economics, it appears to Rail that prisoners in the wage slave jobs have more to gain than those who don't get that work, at least in the narrow economic sense. However, refusing to work in these industries is an effective attack on the prison slave system. As with all oppressive labor systems, refusing to work is the first tool of the rebel worker. The power of the prison strike has not escaped revolutionaries in prison, as Mail to the Mouse internationalist movement reflects. One West Virginia prisoner wrote in 1996,
I have been seriously thinking of means to knock the prison industry off its foundation, as the only way I can see it is for prisoners to quit working for Unicor. This would have to be a plan implemented throughout all of the U.S. prisons. I'm sure that the results would be devastating to the prisons themselves in 6 months or less. Prisoners would have to gradually quit the Unicor. Unfortunately, the ones who are paying for incarceration, assessment, etc., would be hit the worst. They could be subjected to segregation, put on refusal status, or face being shipped to another facility. But you could only do this with so many prisoners. Mass shipment to me is highly unlikely, especially with the prison space growing more scarce each day. The prisoner would also have to use backup buddy systems. The backup friend, if you can find someone you trust, would receive money on their account, small amounts, to buy for that friend his personal needs at the commissary. If a person tried to stock up on many items before quitting Unicor, if that person was to be shipped, they would lose everything, since everything is now being shipped home to your family. We have been receiving many women from other institutions, and their attempts to stock up on items and clothing has backfired. I realize that this would cause a lot of hardship for people, but as I see it, it would be a temporary setback for a short time in comparison to the many years that many prisoners have received on petty drug charges. I feel strongly that this plan will work. We need to pull together and knock the wheels off and take the money out of the slave labor operation. Crack the foundation of the prison drug war. Quit Unicor.
A member of the Texas Prisoners Labor Union wrote in April of that same year,
the Texas Prisoners Labor Union is established to provide inmate laborers with a social and political forum from which to promote principles of social justice in a manner consistent with human rights. The Texas penal colony is one of the most expansive industries in the United States. However, while the populations have swelled to overcapacity, the Texas correctional industry's programs have not kept in step. As a result, basic concepts of imprisonment in Texas remain unchanged from the prior plantation dictates that induced slavery. Inmate laborers in Texas are wholly uncompensated for their work. Conditions remain barbaric in spite of 20 years of formal litigation, offering inmate laborers little hope for the future. There are no effective programs which would allow for an environment wherein rehabilitation and productivity are synonymous. Therefore, those of us who remained confined within the penal colony are doomed to remain chained to the revolving door that has long become the accepted policy of incarceration in Texas. Legislators are happy to accept this concept of incarceration, as it provides Texans with an ever-growing industry, which in turn provides the citizenry of Texas with jobs in various areas of corrections. This insane policy must be stopped, and it is up to us to stop it. We must bind together so as to form a political base from which we may collectively assert our human rights and negotiate collective bargaining for improved working and living conditions, wages and rehabilitative programs that will allow us to develop skills and habits which will lend to our once again entering society as responsible and productive citizens. Daily, the current Texas government is stripping more and more away from us, and will continue to do so until there is nothing left. Only we can stop this onslaught against human rights and social justice. Only we can help ourselves.
These prisoners show the way toward a new path for organized resistance to the system of prison slavery. We can work together on both sides of the prison walls to end the system of American slavery.
This has been Under Lock and Key, a revolutionary anti-imperialist league program about prison. For more information, contact RAIL, P.O. Box 712, Amherst, Massachusetts 01004, or email railradio@mim.org.